We have the ability to save trillions of lives. And I want to just get this. You're listening to Paul Check's podcast right now. If you're listening to Paul's podcast right now, you are, and I want to be just very, I apologize insincerely, but just really direct and straight. You're among a very, very small sector of the world population that's actually thinking about the bigger issues, that is generating and beginning awareness of the meta crisis. You might in your own life be moving from self-help, which is what can I get out, to actually transformation, which is what can I pour in. You're beginning to become aware of the larger meta crisis. You're becoming become aware of the larger field. You're hearing this notion of there's a new story of value that we can actually tell that will allow us to avoid the death of humanity or the death of our humanity. And there's an enormous ecstatic urgency that we actually begin to feel moving through us. And we actually begin to realize that we literally are the ones we've been waiting for, that cliche is actually true.
Welcome to Living 4D with Paul Check. Today, Paul welcomes back Dr. Mark Gaffney. Dr. Mark Gaffney is a social activist and visionary philosopher known for his source code teachings on Eros, unique self theory, and evolutionary love. He is the author of over 25 books, including Return to Eros, co-authored with Christina Kincaid, and Your Unique Self, The Radical Path to Personal Enlightenment. Holding a doctorate in philosophy from Oxford University, as well as Orthodox Rabbinic Ordination, he is the co-founder and co-president, along with Zach Stein, of the Office for the Future, the Center for World Religion and Philosophy, and the Foundation for Conscious Evolution. At the core of their shared mission is the articulation and delivery into culture of a great library intended to evolve the source code of consciousness and culture in response to the meta-crisis. A big thank you to our premier sponsors, Bioptimizers, Paleo Valley, and Organifi. We could not produce this podcast without their support. And of course, Paul only works with companies whose products he loves. All the sponsors offer special discounts for our listeners, so please visit the show notes page at checkinstitute.com/podcast for links and details. Or just keep listening to this episode for the featured products and offers. Today's topic of conversation is first principles and values.
Well, the world needs the book that is coming out right about now, First Principles and First Values. The author is David J. Temple. Temple, the person that we're speaking to today, whose heart and soul is hiding in that book all over the pages, is Mark Gaffney. And forgive me, because I found out today I've been pronouncing his name wrong, so I want all of you to know it's not Gaffney, it's Gaffney. So we got to get it right.
It's actually a Hebraicization of vinyars, which is vineyard, right? Vine. And vine in Hebrew is gefen, right? Gaffney. So it's Gaffney.
Ah, you are the vine that gives us all the beautiful grapes and
vine.
Juice.
Vine is the kind of the Dionysian vine, which is filled with appropriate boundary and hopefully appropriate boundary breaking of all that is contracted and all that's not sacred. Amen. May that be true for all of us.
I love Dionysus and all of his great commentaries, along with Plotinus and others. So your new book, First Principles and First Values, you know, from what you've shared with me, it's extremely important, which is, I'm sure, why you've put it out. Could you give us a little overview of why you did it, what's in it, and why it's so important?
No, thank you. Thank you, Paul.
It's rare for me to do a podcast with you without having already read or listened to one of your books, but because I have such a love of what you share, I didn't need to read it because I know the well that it comes from, and I've drank the water and it's always good. And I'm waiting for it in the mail. So
very sweet. And you are getting it in the mail.
Get me horny about this book and everybody else, please.
Let us arouse the field, right? Let us arouse the field into this book. So first, I just want to say something about the authorship. So the reason the book was published by World Philosophy and Religion Press. The publisher of World Philosophy and Religion Press is our dear friend, who's the board chair of the Center for World Philosophy and Religion, our think tank for the last 15 years. This is the think tank that I founded together with Ken Wilber, Sally Kempton, you know, Barbara Marx Hubbard was the board chair, John Mackey was the board chair, Lori Galperin, our friend Aubrey Marcus, right?
Oh, cool.
Succeeded, right? And who is now the board chair. And, you know, he succeeds in a long, you know, illustrious line, Kate Maloney, of just fabulous board chairs. And Aubrey's really taken on the board chairmanship. And he has founded, together with us, the World Philosophy and Religion Press, which is committed to evolving the source code of consciousness and culture in a very particular way in response to the meta crisis. Now, before we get there, I want to just talk about authorship for a second, because that's interesting. I mean, I'm doing, together with my colleague, Zach Stein, who's the co-president of the center, we're writing essentially a great library, because we actually understand that one book's not going to do it. There's too much noise and not enough signal. And we need to actually establish, like at that moment, you're in Florence, the Black Death, the pandemic is blasting Europe open in a horrific way. The old structures of the traditional world are breaking down. People are dying on the streets, right? Science is trying to find its way. And people are utterly confused. And it looks like it's a time of enormous blackness. They call it the Black Plague. And Florence is partying, and everyone's involved in all the local politics and all the, you know, machinations around their version of elections. Obviously, there weren't democratic elections, but their version of kind of governance. And then there's this small group of people, Paul. The Medicis were involved. Leonardo da Vinci, Marcello Ficino founds the Florentine Platonic Academy. And according to the cultural historian critic Paul Tillich, there weren't more than 1,000 people involved at the core of the Renaissance. But
wow.
Those 1,000 people understood that to respond to the crisis as they're poised between this potential new world and this utter breakdown, the only way to really to respond is to tell a new story.
Amen. Great spirit.
Right? Aho, great spirit, right? You can't get to every village which the Black Death is ravaging. And so what you have to do is you have to actually tell a new story that actually changes our core experience of what it means to be a human being. And it changes the essential trajectory of evolution itself. And this is a very, very deep idea. It's not a simple idea. And what we're actually saying is that reality is not merely a fact. Reality is a story. And story is the ontology of reality. Meaning, story is not something that human beings created. That's what we assume. I was talking to my friend Howard Bloom about this, and Mark said, "What do you mean?" Right? Howard said to me, "Mark, what do you mean?" I mean, stories. Human beings created stories, and we went really deep together. And you know, and at the end, Howard said, "Wow!" And we completely revisioned how we thought about this, because actually, story is a structure of cosmos. It's stories all the way up, and stories all the way down. And a story means that there's a plot line. That there's a direction, there's a telos, a direction, there's a plot line, that there's casual action, causal action, in which one thing affects another thing, that there's some degree of aliveness and freedom in the system, right? And that there's a desire for something, right? Which is part of the plot line. I want something. We're desiring something. So those elements of story exist all the way down. And all the way down.
Yes, they do.
As Whitehead points out, you have, and as Stuart Kaufman, right, points out very beautifully, you have a nascent experience of first person all the way down the evolutionary chain. And that's a really great realization, right, that actually even subatomic particles are living with a desire and allurement to come together and to create something new, which is called an atom. And although their experience of first person is different than Paul's experience of Paulness, obviously, so there's an evolution of the experience of first person. Nonetheless, that core experience in which subatomic particles want to come together, a proton and a neutron and an electron want to come together and form an atom, is not essentially different than Paul and Penny coming together to form a new wholeness of spirit, a new wholeness of heart. But it's the same process. It's eros or allurement all the way down and all the way up. And so the notion of story, right, that there's a plot line, that reality is trying to go somewhere, that there's some freedom in the system, because if there's no freedom, it's not a story. It's a mechanical or it's a tech manual. If there's no freedom in the story, it's a tech manual. But a story means it's not just a tech manual. There's freedom. There's decision. There's allurement. There's acting on that allurement. There's telos. There's direction. There's desire for more value. Those are the five core elements of story. I believe they're more precise than Aristotle's elements of story, which I looked at. Those are that's the structure of reality. And the way the lineage of Solomon sometimes says it is, God loves stories.
Totally.
That's a simple way. God loves stories, meaning story is a structure of reality all the way up and all the way down. Therefore, now it gets very exciting. Therefore, the only thing that changes the course of history is a new story. Not for psychological reasons, but because reality itself is a story. And so therefore, if you want to evolve reality, you have to evolve the story. You know, and you said to me, Paul, in a text, and I'm always, whenever I'm looking down at my phone and I see a text from you, I kind of stop and just, and I kind of breathe in, right? You know, I'm delighted, right? And so you said, you know, it's important today that when we talk and we do this big picture, you know, about this new book, First Principles and First Values, we actually allow people to find it in their lives. So let's do a find it in your life moment. So whenever I work with a couple, and I do very, very little work these days with couples just because of time, but I love the work and it's wildly, you know, important and deep work. My friend Warren Farrell is doing some really deep work in this regard. Yossi Amram is doing deep work in this regard. Lori Galperin, you know, some people doing fantastic work in this regard. But when you work with a couple, when I work with a couple, you know, I take on maybe two or three couples a year and, you know, we spend an enormous amount of time. And one of the things we realize is they have to retell the story of who they are. Right? They're operating within a story. That story is a story of value. If you can't evolve the story of value from within which the couple generates their eros and their reality, it breaks down. So the only way to achieve a breakthrough is not by having, you know, good listening methods, although good listening methods are important. Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg, right? So, you know, good listening moments are important and good methodologies matter and good interventions, which are good, you know, life hacks, are all important and like mad blessings to them, but they don't actually change by themselves the direction of the couple. Those are like infrastructure changes. You want to change a little bit, you want to do some life hacks. You can't just change the infrastructure. You can't just make new rules, new covenants. Those are social structure changes. I'm borrowing terms from Manfred Harris. You actually have to change the superstructure of a relationship. And superstructure means what I would call story of value. Right? And so just like when we're confronting a meta crisis in reality, and we're actually like at that moment in, oh my God, in Florence, when they're poised between, it's a time between worlds, a time between stories, reality's breaking down, and Da Vinci and Ficino, right, funded by the Medicis, they tell this new story of value that ushers in modernity and all the dignities of modernity. So we're now also at this moment of metacrisis where the story is breaking down. What truth means is breaking down, right? The field of value is undermined at its core. We don't know what eros means, right? We don't know, right, how to do sense making. We've lost access to the sensuality that gives us common sense. When all that's breaking down, the only way to respond to the metacrisis is to actually tell a new story of value. And a new story of value can't just be a new story. It's not just a new story. It's a new story of value, which recognizes that value is intrinsic to cosmos and yet evolving at the same time. And that cosmos is rooted in a set of, there's our book, First Principles and First Values. It's rooted in a set of first principles and first values, which are evolving first principles and first values. Right. And those evolving first principles and first values, and here's the drum roll, are the plot lines of cosmos. It's like, so that's such, I mean, we just did such a mouthful there, but it's so fundamental. So just like between a couple, if you don't establish a shared story of value, intimacy breaks down and the couplehood breaks down and the eros breaks down. So too in the intimate communion that we need in our globe today, in order to respond to the meta crisis. Because if we don't have a global intimate communion, we have no chance of responding to the meta crisis. And I just want to say for a moment, I'm going to go on with this notion of global intimate communion, but I just want to get really real about this for a second. What we're talking about is trillions and trillions of lives. Let's just get clear here. When we say a meta crisis, existential risk, what we're saying is that there's two shadows that occlude the light that wants to emerge. And one is the potential death of humanity, existential risk. And the other, which we talked about in a previous conversation, is the potential death of our humanity. Two forms of existential risk. Now, the only way to respond to those two forms of existential risk is through a new story of value. And we talked about why, because we just began to talk about why, because reality is a story at its core. So you can only evolve the vector of reality by telling a new story. So when Da Vinci tells a new story, all of a sudden you get a new kind of science. And when you tell a new story of modernity, you get feminism. And when you tell a new story of value, you get a new vision of the body and sexuality. And when you tell a new story of value, you get universal human rights. And when you tell a new story of value, you get democracy. Right? So all five of those that I just mentioned are actually emergents that come out of the ground of the new story of value, which is the story of modernity that Da Vinci and his cohort tell. Now, this is so critical, and it's such a big, crazy fucking deal, right? They got lots of the story right. And to the extent they got the storyline right, the plot lines right in the Renaissance, we got all of the dignities of modernity. And there are many dignities to modernity. We're living between us in the dignities of modernity. But to the precise extent, brother, that they got some of the plot lines wrong, that they misunderstood something in the plot line, they left out key chapters in the Book of Life, they edited pages from the Book of Life, that created a corruption in the storyline, a corruption in the plot line, which led us directly to the meta crisis, to existential risk, to a world in which exterior technologies are exploding, interior technologies are imploding, and in the gap between interior technologies, which are imploding, and exterior technologies, which are exponentially exploding, we get the meta crisis. We get exponential technology, which has the capacity through 12 or 13 vectors to destroy reality, either through actually the death of humanity, quite literally, or through a techno-totalitarianism, which creates the death of our humanity. The only way to respond to that is a new story of value. Now, that's huge.
I think it's the patient on the emergency ward table right now is our humanity. And it's because that loss of connection, the field of value, the mutual binding factors that hold our story together, that it's going to potentially lead to the death of humanity. And
that's right.
You said trillions of people. That means what's going to kill humanity is also going to kill most of nature. So there's your trillions of beings, right? There's not trillions of humans.
You're totally right. But let's go slow, brother. Okay. So we'll take it step at a time. Now, I think everything is so important, what you're saying. Let me be, with your permission, let me be a commentary on your text. Okay. Okay. So there's two things happening. One is we are at a pivotal generation, the likes of which has never existed before in human history. And to be a lover, to move from being Homo sapien, the old human, into the new humanity, what we might call Homo amor, who's omni-considerate for the sake of the whole, who's an outrageous lover, that move to the new human and new humanity is the pivotal move in human history today, which will determine three things. One, will there be a present? Meaning, will there be a set of extinction events that destroy the present? Number one. Two, if you destroy the present, you essentially cause failure to all of the past, because the past is a covenant between generations, which every generation passes the baton of love and eros and creativity and dignity and value to the next generation and says, pick up that baton and run the next leg of the race. So we will be the generation that did not pick up the baton. And so we will violate the covenant between generations and we will desecrate all of the past. Two, but three, no future will be born. And if you actually do the mathematics, the simple mathematics, Will McCaskill did a good job of the mathematics, you know, kind of citing a bunch of, you know, very, very well-reasoned studies, as did Toby Ord, you know, at Oxford Center for Existential Risk. But basically, we're talking about the unborn trillions of people. So we're talking about trillions of untold love stories, trillions of babies that are never held in the arms of the mother, trillions of transformations that never take place. So we're talking about actually the death of past, present, and future. And we are, for the first time in history, bows and arrows couldn't destroy the planet. B-52 bombers couldn't destroy the planet. We now have exponential technologies which are exponentially more capable of destroying existence than the nuclear bombs were, right? Nuclear bombs were child's play because they required uranium, which could be monitored, and it required kind of state capacities, right, to enrich them, right? We now have forms of existential risk. And again, 12 or 13 vectors, which I'm not going to go into right now, which allow for the death of humanity itself. And those vectors, those factors can't be fixed solely by infrastructure, meaning it's not enough to create a new technology that can figure out whether there's bioweapons in the wastewater. That's infrastructure. That won't work, right? Because it's a multipolar trap world in which everyone is in the race to the bottom because everyone's in a rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics. And you have basically existential technologies, which are exponentially increasing, right, which are being managed by non-state actors, which are available. And they're what Nick Bostrom called in his 2019 essay, The Vulnerability Hypothesis, they're the black ball. You put your hand in an urn and then you get a white ball, great technology, awesome. You get a gray ball, let's say social media, right? Complicated technology, destructive, and also, right, has great benefits, right? A black ball is a technology that doesn't require state actors, that can't be monitored, that can be manufactured very quickly, and that can actually destroy the system. So I won't even mention what they are because it's actually irresponsible to even talk about what they are in public because you don't know who's listening and how, so you don't want to actually be planting those ideas. But we have now, we're on the border of blackball technologies, which will be available to rogue non-state actors. Now, the only way to respond to that is to actually enact a new story of value, which becomes the story of value of reality that we're all actually responsible towards, right? To actually reenact a shared story of value in which all human beings participate. And that's fully possible. See, this is, people say to me, but that's impossible. That would never happen. We could never have a change like that. That's unrealistic to say there can never be a change like that. Unrealistic means you don't know reality. It always changes. Reality means the only thing that never changes is that it always changes. And the rate of change, right, is accelerating. What we don't have is a good story to tell, right? So in order to tell this new story, we have to actually revision value theory. We have to revision eros. We have to revision relationship. And that's what we're doing. That's what this book's about. We have to actually establish what are the 18 first principles and first values of cosmos that are evolving, that can be shared by all of humanity, that can become the new story of value. And within that, all of Paul Check's work, right? All of Mark's work, all of our friend Ken Wilber's work, right? All of that, right? In other words, we can all be a unique self-symphony, each with rich diversity, but we need a context for our diversity, and the context has to be a shared story of value. So this is a big deal.
Hi, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. You know, I love my kids, and I'm sure you love yours too. That's why I'm thrilled to announce that Organifi has just released their new kids line, Organifi Kids, with two initial offers to address the most common needs of children today, Easy Greens and Protect. I can't tell you how important these products are, considering that most children today are not getting enough greens to meet their nutritional needs, not to mention the fact that our children literally are our future. I recently watched an interview with Zen Honeycutt, founder of Moms Across America. She and a panel of experts exposed the fact that most kids' school lunch programs contracted out to fast food corporations, and if that's not bad enough, she ran lab tests on a significant number of kids' school lunches and found that not only was the food very devitalized, but that it was absolutely loaded with high levels of many dangerous pesticides, including glyphosate. As I show in my book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy, most of these pesticides not only disrupt normal hormonal function, they can also cause abnormal growth and development and are commonly linked to cancer, and we have the highest rates of cancer in children in history right now. Organifi's Easy Greens and Protect for Kids are made with organic ingredients and custom formulated for kids 2 and older. Additionally, these excellent, much-needed products are formulated for daily use. The main benefits of the new Kids Easy Greens includes daily superfood greens and gives your child optimal nutritional diversity, and the everyday nutrition in Kids Easy Greens fills common nutritional gaps. Kids Easy Greens is also formulated to support digestive health, which many children need today. The main ingredients in Organifi Kids Easy Greens are nutrient-rich veggies, including carrot, broccoli, sprouts, spinach, and beet, superfoods moringa and chlorella. Digestive support includes digestive enzymes, probiotics, and fiber. Additionally, Organifi's new Protect for Kids offers fast-acting immune support formulated for kids that is gentle enough for daily use. So with Organifi Protect for Kids, you can rest assured their immune system is always being supported. The main ingredients that Protect offers for your kids are orange and acerola cherry, powerful sources of vitamin C and antioxidants. Astragalus, a potent adaptogenic root used to support and boost the immune system. Elderberry, an antioxidant plant nutrient that supports the body's defenses against illness. Propolis, the bodyguard of the beehive, can help naturally prevent sickness and naturally modulate the immune system. These excellent kids' products not only taste fantastic and are low in sugar, they're very easy to use. Just add them to a glass of water or your favorite juice and stir. To get your kids the nutrition and immune support they need and deserve, go to Organifi.com/CHEK20. That's Organifi.com/CHEK20. And on checkout, use the promo code capital C, capital H, capital E, capital K 20 for 20% off. It gives me great joy knowing I can help you find excellent organic nutrition and immune support for your children so they can be as healthy as my kids are.
As you approach a crisis of the magnitude that you've just described with the black ball, I think people start forgetting about colored racial differences, sex differences, religious differences, because we all start to realize that we need the same things to make it together, right? You know, if
absolutely,
if you're out hiking with 20 soldiers and there's no water and you're all dying of dehydration, there's only one first principle: who can find some water? And you know, I think what I'm getting from your description and what my reaction to people saying that it's never going to happen, we how close do we have to get to the unfolding of the black ball before we all go, we all want to live together? And that leads us to, well, what does it take to foster life together? Because we've experimented with fostering death together. Now we know we have to all find water together. And I think that's when the storyline starts becoming congruent and coherent for everybody, because we all realize we're facing a danger that is inescapable without everybody getting involved.
No, that's beautifully said, right? There is no local, there's only global.
Yeah.
There's not actually even only global, there's galactic, right?
Yeah.
Because
cosmic.
We're moving into a galactic world, a cosmic world, right? And if we don't actually establish a cosmic story of value, then we'll basically have interplanetary wars in 200 years, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we actually need a shared story of value, which is the value, which is the inherent structure of reality. And so what I want to try and do is try and understand, so what are these values, right? And why are they so wildly beautiful and alluring? And how do we actually enact them? And it's a very big deal. But the first thing we've established is, already today, we've already talked about one critical value, which is the value of story. Scientists, story itself is a value of cosmos. Story is not just a technical description. You know, we cited earlier from the lineage of Solomon, God loves stories. So let's just think about this for a second. Let's just talk about Penny, because she's here but invisible, and so we're not allowed to talk about her. But let's talk about Penny. What does Penny think about most of the time? Now, we can't, you know, share everything publicly, but most of the time, you know, Penny's thinking about how great Paul is, generally, right? Right.
She's
that.
Probably
right?
Thinking about how to get me to slow down so she'd have right, to manage
probably some of that. And the truth is that what Penny's thinking about all the time, that Mark thinks about and that Paul thinks about and that Christina thinks about and that Krista thinks about, is we're thinking about our story. What should we be doing in our story? We're aware of our story. The more awake we are, the more we're able to follow the thread, the plot line of our story, right? The more we're related, right, to the field of Eros, the more Ariadne's thread connects Theseus, right, to the way to find his way, right, through the labyrinth, right, after he's slain the Minotaur. Right, after you slay the Minotaur, you're like, where you get lost. So you need the thread. That's the thread of your sacred autobiography. Now, what Camus talks about, you know, in his book, The Trial, right? Excuse me, Kafka talks about in The Trial, he talks about this protagonist, K, right? And K loses the thread of his story. He can't. And when you read Kafka's Trial, you're like, right? And the reason I said Camus is because it's the same thing that Camus does. They're both existentialists. At the beginning of his book, The Stranger, right? His great book, The Stranger, where the protagonist says, mother died today. Or was it yesterday? Right? And the point is that mother, the sense of being welcome in cosmos, the sense that my story matters, the sense that there's a plot line, that my story is desired by reality, that my story is ultimately significant, is lost. And so what we first need to reclaim is the first principle and first value of story, not as a therapeutic psychological story, although therapy was important because it recognized that the structure of story mattered, right? But then it tried to work out story without any orienting North Stars of first principles and first values. Story is not just the push of yesterday. Story is the pull of tomorrow. Story is not just working out the traumas of yesterday. It's aligning with the unique plot line of my sacred autobiography, which I begin to realize that actually the universe is a love story. Not as a fanciful conjecture, but as the best reading of the interior and exterior sciences. And I want to say this clearly. The best reading of interior and exterior science available in the world today, when you integrate all the information, I've spent my brother the last 20 years trying to do that. When you integrate all the information, the best understanding of reality is that we live in an amorous cosmos. Yeah. We live in an amorous cosmos. We live in an intimate universe. We live in a cosmo-erotic universe. We live in the universe, a love story. We understand that evolution is the love story of the universe, and that my personal story, Paul Cech's personal love story, is not just his psychology, but it participates in the love story of cosmos, that it adds a critical chapter to the love story of cosmos. And that actually my transformation, therefore, becomes not just my personal self-help work, my transformation in love, the evolution of love that takes place in me, as me, and through me, is the transformation of the whole. Wow. That's homo amor. That's the beginning of the birthing of a new human and a new humanity, who then begins to actually engage all of reality in a completely different way. Because the source of the metacrisis, the metacrisis is driven by what? It's driven by two generator functions that are always at the center. One is rivalrous conflict. Everyone is in rivalrous conflict, governed by win-lose metrics, right? One of the reasons I'm always so excited to talk to you is that we get to get excited. I get to get excited about Paul Cech. Right? We're not in rivalrous conflict. No, but it's a big deal. Like I say, you tell me what you're working on, and I look at your library, which you gave me a tour of, you know, and I look at kind of the expanse of your last decades, and I don't say to myself, why didn't I do that? It's not mine to do, it's Paul's. And I get to be wildly excited in my body, right, at your gifts and at your wonder and at your beauty. And you can feel that. You feel like this guy's not trying to be me. He's excited, right?
I do the same with you.
You do, which is so beautiful.
Your library is bigger than mine. It's just inside your head. I have to climb in there and go for a walk.
Let's not get into the yours is bigger than mine conversation, but okay. Right. But it's crazy exciting because when I recognize the irreducible uniqueness of the Paul love story, I get to be in devotion to that love story. I can bracket myself. I bracket myself and say, how can I be in devotion to the Paul Cech love story? And then all of a sudden, right? There's no longer, jealousy disappears, rivalrous conflict disappears, and there's this new space of eros. Now, that literally doesn't exist in the world. In the world today, we have all the way in every dimension of reality, we have one story that drives everything. We call it a success story. And a success story means zero-sum rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics between people on a team, between teams, between companies, right? Between, you know, departments in government, between governments, between religions, between Sunnis and Shiites, between sectors of religion, between people in the family system, right? Between spiritual teachers all the time, between students who are disaffected and teachers who are disaffected, students who are abusing, right? And it's just all the way down, right? Everyone is in some sort of parasitic relationship of rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics, which de-eroticizes the universe and causes exponential growth curves of this kind of consumption to cover up the emptiness and this formation of self, whether it's a religious self or a national self or a corporate self, right? Covering up the emptiness with pseudo-eros, which creates exponential growth curves, right? Which, and multipolar traps of a race to the bottom. We can't even regulate AI. I mean, just think about this for a second. 3 months ago, all over the world, my friend, all 4 months ago, 5 months ago, people realized, holy shit, right? Right? Hinton resigns from Google. Google, AI is an existential risk. People like, get it. For the first time, mainstream newspapers, for the first time in history, you have mainstream newspapers all over the world who talk about artificial intelligence, about the genuine existential risk. And by existential risk, we don't mean that AI is going to take over the system. That's the most minor risk, right? Existential risk of AI is multiple and multi-vectored, and we can do a whole dialogue on it. But let's just bracket that for a second. 4 months later, no one's talking about it. What happened? Where did it go?
Someone's controlling the narrative.
That's right. Where did it go? It disappeared. And actually what happened in OpenAI, as they're doing ChatGPT-4 all the way up to ChatGPT-7, is there was a huge conflict that took place there in which actually there were two vectors in their board of directors. And there was one vector that was actually deeply concerned about existential risk. They were connected to the effective altruism folks. They got weakened because of Sam Bankman-Fried and the whole crypto explosion. Right? They had a couple of seats on the board of OpenAI. And you have Sam Altman kind of aligned with Nardella and aligned with Microsoft. And they basically, you know, in a struggle, essentially took control of OpenAI. It was witnessed all over the world. And essentially the triumphalists won out over those who were actually seriously concerned with existential risk. And existential, now why? Well, part of the reason is no one wants to lose the race. So what people say is, well, if we're gonna curtail our deployment of artificial intelligence, someone else is gonna do it. And so we can't actually trust the agreements. And since we have no shared story of value, we have no trust between us. We have no shared code of honor, right?
That's exactly what Elon Musk said. People asked him, well, if this is so dangerous, why do you keep doing it? He said, because if I don't do it, someone else will. And at least if I do it, I have some control on the outcome.
In other words, what modernity and postmodernity have done is they've destroyed a shared story of value, which could potentially give us a shared code of honor. So we need to restore that story. And I don't know if you're up for it, but you're up for it. We could actually go into, and I don't know if your listeners are up for like this crazy, wild, exciting deep dive. Why did the story of value break down and how do we fix it?
Yeah, right? I want to just make a point before you do that. Of course I'm up for it. That's why I'm hanging out with you.
Cheers.
You know, having studied a lot of James Carse's work in his book, Finite and Infinite Games, he makes the distinction that finite games always have winners and losers, but infinite game players don't. They play to win because it's sport, it's fun, but that's not the point. The point is to keep playing the game. And so everyone's orientation is ultimately, how do we keep everybody playing? And I think that's a key distinction in the world
that.
Right now.
I love that, Paul. So I don't know Carse's work. You've mentioned it to me. Find it in infinite games. How do we keep everyone playing the game? So let's say if we can integrate Carse's work into the story. Okay, let's integrate this into the story. Okay? Let's go back to our thread, and then we're going to come directly back to Carson. We're gonna weave that in because I think that's actually really, really crazy beautiful. I love that. So the first generator function of existential risk, and We've talked about it at the center for 10 years, Barbara Marks Hubbard, who was my beloved evolutionary homemate, dear friend of mine and Christina's, you know, talked for many, many years about win-lose metrics, being kind of this rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics, which breaks the system apart and generates these exponential growth curves. That's one. Two, what win-lose metrics generates is what Nassim Taleb called fragile systems, or what Snowden called complicated instead of complex systems. And in my telling of the story, and David J. Temple's telling of the story, complicated systems means systems in which the parts are not allured to each other. Let me say it in Karst's terms that you invoked, the parts don't want to play with each other.
Yeah, or they want to make sure someone loses and only they win.
That's right. They don't want to play with each other. So a complex system would be a Brazilian rainforest, Snowden points out, right? So there's allurement between the parts. You know, a Ferrari would be a complicated system. A Ferrari is inherently fragile, right? If you're missing one piece, right, it breaks down. You got to send away to the factory. It may be open. It may not be open. There's no inherent allurement between the parts. So rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics generates complicated, fragile systems that optimize for efficiency and not for resilience. And so therefore, when there's fragility, for example, COVID, right, which is this relatively minor pandemic, which is hijacked, right, by all sorts of forces and all sorts of ways, different conversation.
Finite
right?
game players.
This is a relatively minor pandemic. We should have been able to save 4/5 of the people, which we didn't. I mean, it was a serious disease, obviously. People died all over the world. We should have been able to engage it. That's a different conversation. But what happens is the system breaks down because the system is optimized, right, for quick short-term profit and efficiency, not for resilience. So we have two generator functions of existential risk. One, rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics. Two, that itself generates fragile, complicated systems where the parts don't know each other. So for example, you know, someone at the Bear Stearns office in the Far East can create a new financial instrument that ripples through Europe and then into the United States, and that plays a significant part in the mortgage meltdown, right, of 2008, right? Because the people making that instrument, right, have no idea. They're dissociated from the system. So now let's go even deeper. Now this is really exciting. Exciting in the sense that we can actually address the meta crisis and create this new world. So what is the underlying root cause underneath even the two generator functions? Meaning underneath rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics, underneath complicated systems, what's the underlying root cause? A global intimacy disorder.
I was going to say a lack of connection.
Right? A global intimacy disorder. So rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics, meaning we look at each other as rivals. We don't want to, and this is, you invoked the word so beautifully, play. Right? We forget that we're homo ludens. Right? We play.
What's that mean?
Homo ludens, right, was coined by a Dutch philosopher, is that the characteristic of a living human being is that we want to play together. And when we play together, we're playing together because in playing, there's a field of eros, right?
That's why music is so beautiful and alluring.
That's right. That's right.
Because we must play together.
That's right.
To make music.
Now, that's gorgeous. I would say both music and sports, paradoxically, are places where we still have a glimmering of this possibility of eros, which is why people get so right enamored with sports. They're sports fans because they notice something. Oh, there's a field of play, right? And there's a set of rules, and there's intrinsic values that everyone subscribes to, and there's a coherence, and there's a resonance between the players. And although there's also win-lose metrics, there's also a team, and there's a coherence between the team, and the team is larger than any individual because, you know, the New York Jets go on, you know, whoever the quarterback is, right? You know, and they can have a great quarterback. They got a great quarterback this year who got injured. He's going to have a great season next year. But in other words, whatever happens is there's something larger. So sports and then music is the interior feeling of allurement in cosmos written in song. And music is a quality, as you know, there's no music before manifestation. In other words, scientifically, music is the intervals, right? The space between, that's music. Music is a quality of the manifest. And I won't do a deep dive into the science now, but essentially we are music. We're actually made up, if you will, of atoms of music. And the reason we're moved by the musical is because we are music.
What Om is.
That is what Om is, my brother.
That's what in the beginning was the word. And the word is the word. Wording.
And all of music is love songs. Why is that? Music is transtemporal across all time. It's transcultural across all space. And it's always love songs. It might be love of country, and it might be love of sister, and it might be a country song that has a truck, right? But in other words, you know, there's always, it's always a love song, because reality is a love song. Reality is a musical score of Eros. And here's the wild, and Eros is the core value of Cosmos. And it's, Eros is not a detail. Eros is actually the value of Cosmos. In other words, Eros is, and I want to invoke with your permission, it's actually in this book. We have a series, I told you, of 18 interior science equations.
I just have a question.
Absolutely.
Because of what's going on in the world right now and the World Economic Forum, and I don't know if you've had the joy and the shock of listening to or reading Seamus Bruner's new book, Controligarchs. I know someone, for example, like James Tunney, who's an expert on the issues of globalism and scientism and all that. If he had been listening to this podcast right now, I'd expect a text message any second saying, Paul, you have to be very careful because this smacks of globalism. But I want to give you a chance to distinguish the fact that you're not at all eradicating the beauty of individuality or the beauty of different races and religions. Right, but that's the distinction I want to make, because so far the conversation can almost sound like we're becoming socialists or communists. We're all doing the same thing. There's only one story. So, I mean, I know where you're going because I know you well enough, but I want to make sure that the listeners understand.
Let's establish very clearly. We need a shared musical score, or we need a shared story of value as a context for our diversity.
Right. Just like a band is made of many instruments, we're not all playing one instrument.
We call this, right, in the new story of value, cosmorotic humanism, we call this a unique self-symphony. In a unique self-symphony, you have unique nations, and you have unique companies, and you have unique vectors of Eros. So there's a unique self-symphony. Every unique self is irreducible and has irreducible dignity and cannot be collapsed merely into the one. That's critical. I mean, the first major book I wrote in kind of the public culture realm, not in a kind of a lineage, you know, I used to write Aramaic lineage books, but the first book I wrote in a kind of public culture vein was called Unique Self. It's about unique self and unique self symphony. And it's about the irreducible value of irreducible uniqueness, which essentially was written to counter any notion of a reductive homogenization into this kind of one story or the one. No, and it's actually beautiful in the original Hebrew. The word one, echad, means unique and singular and one. So In other words, there's always a dialectic between radical individuation, but it's not the individuation of separate self. It's the higher individuation beyond ego, right? It's when my separate self realizes I'm part of true self. I'm part of the field of consciousness and desire. And then my true self then individuates as my unique self, which is my irreducibly unique expression of that field. And then I individuate more deeply as evolutionary unique self. I realize the pulse of evolution moves through my uniqueness. And from there, we come together not to reduce uniqueness. The reduction of uniqueness is totalitarianism. That's critical, right? And it's the entire web. And the World Economic Forum and multiple vectors is based on the elimination of irreducible uniqueness, in which every person gets their universal basic income, right? They're kind of taken care of, and they're bland bots, right? On the worldwide web, which is run by upgraded algorithms generating downgraded human beings. We're saying precisely the opposite, right? We're saying, no.
Do you see why I wanted you to make this?
No, thank you. No, I madly appreciate it, brother. I madly appreciate it. And that's wildly important.
Hello, my fellow spiritual warriors and world workers. I hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as I am. It is no secret that today we are not only bombarded with so-called health and fitness information from every angle, be it social media, TV, podcasts, etc., but clearly, it's not working. Many studies conducted worldwide show that children, teens, adults, and the elderly are the most unhealthy, overweight, and the sickest they've ever been. But it does not have to be that way for you. When I wrote my book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy, I researched the number of diet books available at that time, and there were over 5,000 of them, each claiming to have the right diet for anyone and everyone. But the reason I wrote How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy was because these books all overlook the fact that no two people are the same, and therefore no two people are likely to get good results on the same diet. That's simply fact. Another reason the myriad of diet approaches available today fail so often is that they don't look at the underlying causes that lead to body health and mental-emotional challenges. They treat the human being as though it were a machine, and all you need to do is add this liquid or that supplement, and presto, the machine runs again. These issues are more important than ever considering the physiological, mental, emotional, environmental stress and toxicity in the world today. Today, it is critical to learn the essentials of how to eat, hydrate, breathe, cultivate life force energy, and use your mind to create the life you've always wanted to live. This is exactly what you will learn in our upcoming Holistic Lifestyle Coach Level 1 training program, live with my wife and master instructor, Angie Check, May 31st through June the 2nd, 2024. This workshop is designed for anyone that genuinely wants to be healthy and is ideal for fitness enthusiasts, athletes, and parents. It's also a great chance to explore and see if you want to move into our Holistic Lifestyle Coach Level 2, which is our professional level training, and pursue a career as a Holistic Lifestyle Coach today when it is so desperately needed. Not only will you be taught by Angie Check, one of the most knowledgeable experts in holistic health in the world, I will make guest appearances and answer questions. HLC 1 on May 31 through June 2nd is a rare opportunity to take HLC 1 training live at our beautiful rainbow home atop of a mountain in Fallbrook, California with beautiful views, and you get to enjoy my amazing stone-charged water and work out in my beautiful gym. Additionally, this is the only HLC 1 Live scheduled for 2024. So if you want to learn from a true master in person and get your most important questions answered, don't miss this special opportunity. If you want to meet other holistically minded people and grow your conscious community, there's no better place than our live workshops. In this important, practical 3-day training program, you will learn how to apply the 1-2-3-4 approach to developing long-term body-mind changes and how to apply the 5 essential program design factors. Learn to use your Check nutrition and lifestyle questionnaires for assessing physiological load and making essential diet and lifestyle changes. Understand the relationship between the 6 Check Foundation Principles and body-mind stress. Learn how to apply the 6 Check Foundation Principles to balance your body system so you can exemplify well-being. Identify common roadblocks to success with diet and lifestyle modifications and gain simple solutions. Discover how to use the less is more principle of exercise prescription. Early bird investment is only $810 for this 3-day workshop if you register before April 16th. To learn more and register, go to chekinstitute.com/core. That's chekinstitute.com/core. I'm sure this will be a life-changing workshop for anybody that attends, and I look forward to seeing you all here at our beautiful home in Fallbrook, California. Enjoy.
The mistake of the libertarians, right, and the mistake of the postmodernists, and the mistake of the entire Western Academy is they said, wow, we're going to rebel against the communion and we're going to create radical autonomy, but then that autonomy, that individuation, dissociated from the field of value. If you go to ChatGPT-3 and you ask before GPT, you say, is value real? They say, no, value is not real. Value is what each individual thinks. Each individual has their own value, right? There's no way to have a field of value. If there's no field of value...
You see this in the gender crisis.
You see it in the gender crisis. There has to be a shared field of value, or what we might call a shared grammar of value, as a context for our diversity. That is the future. So existential risk is based on a global intimacy disorder. And this really, you really got to the core of it. A global intimacy disorder is based on, this is how we started, my brother. A global intimacy disorder is rooted in one thing and one thing only. There's no shared story of value. You can't, we just got back to the beginning, right? There's no shared story of value. And this notion that we can actually have a world in which everyone articulates their own value without a shared story of value that binds us as a context for our diversity will cause the death of humanity. It will destroy open societies. And the only choice left will be techno-totalitarian closed societies.
When a human body loses a shared field of value,
correct,
it's called an autoimmune disorder.
That's correct, or cancer.
And that's what we have.
That's correct. And that's beautifully, beautifully said. In other words, in the human body, every cell is aware of every other cell.
Yes.
There's non-local intelligence. And yet cells individuate into particular organisms and perform particular functions and are irreducibly unique and have a love intelligence. There's a love intelligence that inheres in cells. And if you look at, by the way, James Shapiro's work on natural genetic engineering at the University of Chicago, he's talking about the irreducible, unique intelligence of the cellular structure. And yet there's a body politic, if you will. And when there's a notion that I create my own value and I ignore the shared field of value, that's called metastasizing cancer. And so we need to reject two positions. One position is we lose irreducible uniqueness, and we all kind of meld into some technocratic, techno-totalitarian one, which is kind of a hidden
zombie apocalypse.
Right, that's right. And that's B.F. Skinner that we talked about when we were together last time. And that's his book, Walden 2, which describes turning the world into a Skinner's box, right? Which is invisibly controlled by technologies of control. So we reject that homogenization. We also reject the utterly absurd notion that dominates the West today, which is there are no intrinsic values in the world. There's no field of value. There's no story of value. We need a shared story of value. And here's the last thing, Paul, because what arouses us? You said in the beginning, you said, okay, arouse me to this book. Okay. I think you said, make me horny about this book, but let's go with arouse me to this book. Okay. So there's a field of arousal. What arouses me? And the word arouse, it's a very precise and beautiful word. It's the same word as awake. In Hebrew, it's the same two-letter root. What awakens me to something? What arouses me, right, to a book? I actually am able to, right, I'm able to feel that this book is aligned, is unpacking the structure of value in cosmos itself. So my political will, my moral will, my erotic will is aroused by value. So if George Floyd is killed, right, and we're in the middle of COVID and people see this, you know, very, very tragic and horrendous story playing out, right, on national television, whatever happened there, right? But whatever happened there, it was a horror, right? However you tell that story, and people are outraged and they pour into the streets because their moral will was aroused. But if you basically don't have any relationship to the field of values, so for example, if you think there's no free will and freedom's not real and love's not real and eros is not real, then you basically produce techno-totalitarianism. So either you get Walden 2, Skinner's Walden 2, where he says explicitly love's not real, or you get Orwell's 1984, which is run by the Ministry of Love, that's what they call it, which is the hijacking and commodification of love, right? And the hijacking of love, right, to actually destroy any true connection, any true eros between, you know, Julia and Winston. And so we desperately, more than anything in the world, we need to realize we're at a time between worlds, we're at a time between stories. There's a global intimacy disorder. How do we respond to a global intimacy disorder? Actually generating new intimacies.
Yeah.
Right? New intimacies.
I agree.
Right? Yep. New intimacies between us, new ways of relating, new contexts for relating. And that always has to be a shared story of value. And the shared story of value, and maybe this will be part two of what we talk about, the shared story of value's got to be rooted in a realization that intimacy and eros are the core values of cosmos.
Just because you've used love and eros as separate words, I think because there might be a lot of listeners that haven't listened to our previous podcast and may not be really tuned into the
distinction of eros versus love, or may not really know what it is you mean when you use the word. What are you really saying when you say things like shared value of eros? Because I think it's critical that everybody be on the same sheet of music here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. That's beautiful. And by the way, Paul, I apologize if I'm too excited about this and too urgent about it. I can't change it, but if it's a little too much, I apologize.
No, it's look, I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm you know how quick I am to interject if I have something to say. Me and you are like fencers that love each other.
We are awesome.
But I think what you're saying is so
it's the
important.
Future of our world. We're going to break down without it.
This is not a tomorrow issue. I mean, this is a right fucking now issue.
That's right. And in order to avoid becoming a doomer, and there's a growing doomer population, we actually have to embrace the celebration of possibility. And
yes.
We have to actually access the urgency, but the urgency is not, the urgency is an ecstatic urgency.
All challenges are opportunities.
Right. We have the ability to respond to the meta crisis and create the future. We have the ability to save trillions of lives. And I want to just get this. You're listening to Paul Check's podcast right now. If you're listening to Paul's podcast right now, you are, and I want to be just very, I apologize insincerely, but just really direct and straight. You're among a very, very small sector of the world population that's actually thinking about the bigger issues, that is generating and beginning awareness of the meta crisis. You might in your own life be moving from self-help, which is what can I get out, to actually transformation, which is what can I pour in. You're beginning to become aware of the larger meta crisis. You're becoming to become aware of the larger field. You're hearing this notion of there's a new story of value that we can actually tell that will allow us to avoid the death of humanity or the death of our humanity. And there's an enormous ecstatic urgency that we actually begin to feel moving through us. And we actually begin to realize that we literally are the ones we've been waiting for, that cliche is actually true.
Yeah, it's not a cliche.
And it became a cliche because it was pointing to something true, and it got hijacked, right, in a very kind of, you know, superficial way. And the opposite of the holy is the superficial, but it's actually true. And it's, we have to become the articulators of the new story. We have to become the tellers of the new story. We have to realize that the story is unfinished, that we're writing its next chapter. We have to realize that we have to live the new story, right? We have to live the new story of value.
But that depends on openness and creativity. That's a key distinction.
Yes.
Which means we have to let go of rigid ideas, dogmas, and we have to be open to possibility and creative in our pursuits, which is one of the reasons I'm an artist and I teach art. Because people need to practice creativity. Right. That's why I stack rocks. That's why I play with kids.
Yeah,
you know,
you're gorgeous. You're totally right. So let's maybe talk about that just for a second. Then we'll come back to eros and love and what they mean. That was your question. So we're going to hold that in advance. But let's just talk about it for a second. You said so many important things. Let me just pick up on two of them. Right, you talked about we need to give up rigidity, which right, we need to give up the dogmas of yesterday. But not into, right, a world in which there's no field of value. It's not, we gave up dogma, and so now there's nothing that's intrinsic or real. No, we give up dogma, and we move from dogma to dharma.
There right. You go.
Right?
That's a great move.
Right? I move from dogma to dharma.
So explain dharma for the listeners, because many won't know what it really means.
So dharma is an Eastern word, but dharma is similar to what I'm calling the field of value or the story of value. Dharma is an articulation of the intrinsic nature of reality. Now, what the dharmic masters didn't understand is that dharma evolves. Dharma is both eternal and evolving. So dharma is not completely dissimilar from the word the Tao, right? So they talk about the eternal Tao. That's only half true. And as the ancient masters got half of it right and half of it wrong, they thought the eternal Tao means it's everlasting and unchanging. That's incorrect. The eternal Dharma doesn't mean it's unchanging. It means there's a root core field of value. And then the eternal Tao is the evolving Tao. right? The eternal Dharma is the evolving Dharma. And here we get to something so important. And if we're up for it, just with your listeners, we can do this insanely deep dive. And it would seem arcane, but it's not. Everything rests on this next piece. See, that Dharma got rejected, the reason that the Tao got rejected, C.S. Lewis talks about the technologists. He doesn't call them that. He calls them the omnipotent, right? What is the word he uses? He uses, right, those with the controllers who are in control of irresistible scientific methods that are omnicompetent, who will in the end be the few men who rule over all men. And he writes this in a book called The Abolition of Man, right, which is a short book when he's describing what we're calling the death of our humanity. So he talks about how the technologists, right, he doesn't use that word. He calls them these controllers. They've stepped out of the Tao. But he misses something. He's beautiful, but he misses something. The reason they stepped out of the Tao, and whoever's willing, we're going to do like this huge, crazy deep dive for 3 minutes, but if you get this, everything changes. So the reason they stepped out of the Tao is because the people who talked about the Tao said the Tao is the eternal Tao. But they forgot about evolution, right? The dharmas of, let's say, the great religions were all established before the emergence of the feminine, before there was universal human rights, right? Before we had actually embraced the full sacredness of the body, before we had any notion of democracy. Certainly, notion that people could vote was, you know, insane, right? There was this massive, you know, kind of totalitarian brutality, right? The irreducible dignity of the unique individual didn't exist. So the dharmas of the great religions were established before all those principles of modernity. And so the notion that it's just an eternal dharma is not right. So the modernity people said, oh God, they used words like love, but actually it was just a fig leaf for their dogmas. And how did they prove it? That's what they said. Oh, you're talking about love? Well, love 1500 years ago might mean you love Christ, so you commit a crusade. Or love might mean you love the emperor, so you butcher people, but you're calling it love. And so basically Voltaire, right, David Hume, right, each in their own way basically said, this is ridiculous. There is no objective real thing called love. That's a social contrivance, right? There is no eternal Tao. Human beings make it up anew in every generation. That was half right and half wrong. There is an eternal Tao. Eros is real. Love is real. And love evolves. The eternal Tao, it's such a deep thing. The eternal Tao is the evolving Tao. The eternal Dharma is the evolving Dharma. So on the one hand, and this is how we reclaim the field of value. It's love is real. What does love mean? Love means this desire for deeper contact and greater wholeness. That's the Eros equation. Eros means, and I'll talk about Eros means the experience of radical aliveness, seeking, desiring ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness. That's the Eros equation in this book, First Principles and First Values. So that Eros equation applied 2,000 years ago. It applied 10,000 years ago.
It will apply in a million years.
Right, it applies to subatomic particles becoming an atom, right? Macromolecules intensifying their intimacy, as Stuart Kaufman describes it, and then becoming a cell, right? Single cellular, you know, cells that are actually threatened in their existence, and they have this massive, what we might call an oxygen crisis, which then causes them to generate a new emergent of intimacy, which is actually multicellular life, right? But all the way up and all the way down, the same Eros formula applies. So Eros is real. And the reason I use the word Eros and not love, which was your question, is because when we think about love, we think about love as a mere human social construction.
That's why I defined love. I've right. shared it before, but that's why I defined love.
Yeah, beautiful. Exactly. Which is why I defined Eros. Beautiful, my brother. Right? Beautiful. So what we're saying is love is real. It's not just a social construction. It's not just as Skinner writes in his book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which became the hidden Bible of the MIT Media Lab, where he writes a chapter on values, and he says, love is basically just a positive reinforcer, right? It's a social construction which gives you positive reinforcement. No. Love is absolutely real. Love is ultimate reality. Love is Eros, right? Eros is not mere human sentiment. Eros is the heart of existence itself. And that's what we call outrageous love. That's what we call evolutionary love. And that's what we call Eros. And sexuality is but one expression of the erotic motive of the cosmos. Because, of course, as you and I know, Paul, right, there are 12 billion years of Eros before there's any sex.
Yeah, well, depends on how you define sex, but go ahead.
No, but this is important. Sex appears at a particular time, 12 billion years into cosmos, right? So Eros, the actual sexuality, we know as sexuality, is 12 billion years later, right? Subatomic particles coming together to form atoms is Eros.
Yeah, I'm just making the distinction. I would call that sex because you have the merger of the masculine and the feminine, the positive and the negative.
No, I understand. I'm calling sex what kind of how sex is formally understood, right? In the science.
Yeah, you mean copulation.
Well, no, even before, right? In other words, asexual reproduction and to sexual reproduction, right? That's 12 billion years in. So the point is, sex is an expression of Eros. I think we're both saying the same thing.
Sex evolution.
Right? Evolution is erotic. We live in an erotic field. We live in a field of Eros, and Eros itself is value. It's not that one of the values of cosmos is Eros. Eros is the core value of cosmos itself.
You know, based on our previous conversations, your definition of pseudo Eros fits to the disease that has us. We're really all of this virtual reality headsets and the living on social media and, you know, the propaganda and all the illusions, the disillusion of truth. The CIA's attempt stated years ago, our job will be done when no one knows what the truth is. This is all pseudo Eros. This is pornography writ large, for lots of money and with lots of pain.
It's beautifully and tragically said. Eros is the experience of the impulse of cosmos desiring deeper contact and greater wholeness. That's real Eros. Pseudo-Eros is when I can't access that experience of the erotic motive of cosmos alive in my life. So pseudo-Eros says, so I feel radically empty and I try and cover up the emptiness with pseudo-Eros, which is all forms of acting out, all forms. And social media, right, actually steps into a world in which there's no field of value. So I'm not aligned with value. There is a field of value, but we experience ourselves outside the field of value, right? Philosophy departments, religious departments, the legacy media all teach there's no field of value. Right. David Brooks writes, a couple of weeks ago, right, in the New York Times, he says, I was just talking to Douglas Hofstetter and Douglas is worried. I can't understand really the difference between a human being and artificial intelligence. The difference is everything. That's not confusing.
That's somebody that really needs some serious help.
But that is in the mainstream of the legacy culture because we've rejected the value of personhood.
That's why I say that we're in an all hands on deck situation.
We are in an all hands on deck situation, my brother. And we can bring to that situation not a doomer mentality, but this enormous ecstatic.
Bloomer. We can be a boomer mentality.
We're going to bloom. I love that. We go from doomer to bloomer. We bloom reality open with a new story of value. We tell the new story.
We have to breathe into it.
We have to breathe into it and
inspire.
We have to inspire and we have to restore what I might call, with permission, brother, the aspirational human. Right?
Yeah.
And the aspiration, right? Meaning I'm aspiring to nobility. I'm
totally
aspiring to ever deeper uniqueness and to ever more profound intimacy, right? To ever, more gorgeous, irreducible expressions. Right, of my goodness, truth, and beauty, which is precisely the opposite of a webplex that moves to manipulate the lowest common denominator of the human being.
Yeah, exactly.
The entire web is built on exploiting your impulse control. And by the way, if a listener just wants a direct experience of it, it's really simple. Just This is your iPhone. This is your iPhone. Just take a look. How long can you stay away from your iPhone? How do you feel? How do you feel if your iPhone's lost?
That's why I say a phone makes a much better tool than a master.
Right. That's right. No, that's right. And somehow people can actually realize somehow, right, a bunch of private companies, right, whose motivation is ultimately win-lose metrics, have actually penetrated your psyche and made you feel incomplete, deficient, right, for not actually owning and accessing your iPhone. That's shocking.
That's pseudo-Eros right there.
That's pseudo-Eros right there.
We've been infected with it.
We've been infected by it. And we've been infected with it.
Hi, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the show. You know, people worldwide are not only finding it hard to find organic and free-range, regeneratively farmed animal foods, but as you surely know, it's almost impossible to find anything worth eating in stores, airports, gas stations, or even in the stores that should have real food. Additionally, most children are sent to school to eat microwave-processed, chemically raised, and chemically laden garbage from school cafeterias or out of their lunchbox simply because most parents just aren't aware of the dangers of commercial food. But the truth is, there are no shortcuts to health and wellness. Unless, of course, you let Paleo Valley do the work for you. Autumn Smith, founder of Paleo Valley, is not only a mother who understands the importance of feeding children wholesome, clean foods, but is a holistic nutritionist who pours her soul into all Paleo Valley products. And Paleo Valley's meat sticks are made from regeneratively farmed animals that are raised with the highest possible standards of care. Paleo Valley's meat sticks are also fermented, which significantly enhances the nutritional quality and flavor of them. My family and I love them and carry them everywhere we go, be it during rides in the car, outings, ski trips, or we put them in the kids' lunchbox and they love them. In fact, many people I know resort to them as a meal when time is tight on the road or traveling by air. I know of no better portable food or snack food anyone can eat without losing quality or satisfaction, and we love sharing them with our guests and students at our Rainbow Workshops. Paleo Valley's meat sticks come in beef, turkey, and pork maple bacon flavor.
To try Paleo Valley's meat sticks, including the brand new grass-fed venison sticks, and save 15% on your purchase, go to paleovalley.com/check15. That's paleovalley.com/check15, and your 15% discount will automatically be applied when you check out. No promo code is required.
Okay, so we're doing a really beautiful job of outlining the kind of the state and the necessity for understanding the field of value and first principles. How would you encapsulate the disorder that we have? We talked about an autoimmune disorder. Encapsulate what's really going on in the world and then swing us into why what you've written in the book is so important, and give us some of the ideas of what you're sharing with us in the book so we understand why this book's important to study and how important it is relevant to the disorder.
Fantastic. I mean, thank you, Paul, right? You know, I said to Krista and to Christina in the break, I said, you know, I want to try and, you know, actually almost like find this deep center so that the ecstatic urgency of this moment comes across to people clearly. Because as you said, it's all hands on deck. We are at the pivoting point of world history, truly and for real. And so we need to, and what we're trying to do in this book and First Principles and First Values, what we're actually trying to do is to actually tell the new story of value. So imagine that we're in the Renaissance, we're in Florence. Florence is happening right now in this conversation between Mark and Paul, and in a small set of other conversations with beautiful people around the world. And we're telling this new story of value. And to tell the new story of value is two parts. One is to understand the global intimacy disorder. Two is to understand the new vision of the intimate universe. You need both. They're both, right? They're both absolutely true. And let's maybe focus, because we've talked somewhat about the global intimacy disorder that underlies the generator functions of existential risk. And actually, in the book, we talk about 13 dimensions of the global intimacy disorder. So we actually go through them very clearly. But what I'd like to do here is actually step into hope. You know, hope is a memory of the future. So let's see if we can let's see if we can articulate a memory of the future. And how do you change a world? I'm literally, you know, in this kind of this last part of our conversation, how do we become world changers? It's a real question. And what's the playbook?
Are you asking me? Or are you just making a statement?
Right. Well, both, right? In other words, it's a rhetorical question and a real question, of course, in dialogue. And what this book is about is how do you become a world changer? I mean, that's the question we're asking. How do you become a world changer? And how do you become a world changer when it's not just 150 people, you know, the Dunbar number in a small, you know, clan, you know, in the prehistoric world, but you have to become a world changer in a world that, you know, is moving to 8 billion people. How do you become a world changer? And in some sense, that's the question that Turing asked in his essay Morphogenesis. You remember Turing was the code cracker in World War II, right? They did that movie around about him, didn't they? What was it called? The Imitation Game, I think, or something like that.
I don't know. I just know. I know how seriously badly he was treated because of his sexual orientation.
He was treated horribly, right? And he dies in 1952 in a complex set of circumstances that are unclear, but none of them are good. But he was an epic. He's one of my great heroes. So after World War II, he goes to Bell Lab in 1947-48. And, you know, it's around the time that Shannon is developing information theory. And he writes this epic essay called Morphogenesis. And it's a very complex scientific essay. But at the root of the whole thing, he's asking a question, or at least one of the questions is, how do you generate coherent complexity? Right? Now, coherent complexity is actually a fancy way of saying, how do you generate a story with vast numbers of players? Right, you know, exponential numbers of players, what we call today in metamodern thought, a hyperobject, right? So many different, you know, vast numbers of trillions of pieces, and yet the story coheres. And yet the story makes sense.
You need unity and diversity holding hands.
So you need unity and diversity holding hands. So beautiful. So what he says is, and you're expressing an expression of it, brother, he says, well, the way you get to coherent complexity is through iterating again and again simple first rules. So a first rule might be unity and diversity in right relationship, for example. But there's simple first rules, simple micro patterns, first rules of reality that you iterate them again and again and again and again, and they generate the fabric of coherent complexity. Now, Turing is talking about the exterior world, but how do you generate coherent complexity in culture, in society, right, in consciousness, in politics, in governance, in economics, so that we're no longer talking about the physical substrate of the world, because that's the question that Turing's asking. He's saying in the physical substrate, how do we generate coherent complexity? What we're asking, Paul, is how do we generate coherent complexity, right, in the fabric of the conscious universe? In the fabric of governance, in the fabric of economics, in the fabric of relationships, right? In the fabric of, right, of culture. So when you think about it deeply, and I remember this hit me, you know, 13, 14 years ago, you realize that the same way you generate a coherent story, if you will, in the exterior substrate, in the physical substrate of the world, you do the exact same thing in culture and consciousness. You need simple first rules and first principles, what we're calling first principles and first values, that you iterate again and again and again, and they create coherent complexity. So what I would love to do is, in our last period of time, so what are these simple first rules and first principles? What are they? So if you think about it for a second, you got to go, it's got to be elementally simple, but simple not in the sense of dumb, right? Simple meaning you're embracing all of the complexity, and you've gotten to a second simplicity, this elegant principle. So really, there's three basic questions that we're always asking. And the answer to those questions are the simple first rules, the simple first principles and first values. And what are the three questions? We're asking them all the time. And they're the questions that define reality. We're always asking, where am I? Where are we? We're asking, who am I? Who are we? And we're asking what, which is what ought I do? What ought we do? Now, notice that I didn't put in why. We can actually do without the why question. The why question gets us lost in theologic. People make up dogmas about why. Let's forget about the why. The why is in many ways a mystery. We can't actually easily answer the why without getting into dogma. Let's go simple.
Remember, the why is the who.
Well, in some sense, the why is the who and the what and the where, right? So you're right.
Yeah,
in other
yeah.
words, yeah, you're absolutely, brother, that's beautiful. And the reason we left out the why is because you're absolutely right. The why is taken care of when you answer the first three. So where am I? That's the universe story. Who am I? That's the story of identity. What ought be done, which is
the story of love.
Which is, what are the acts of love? What are the outrageous acts of love that are mine to do and mine alone? So let's see if we can just walk through this and let's build it together. Okay, let's build it together. So let's start with, where am I? So where am I? That's how we began. And I'll do a take, you do a take, okay? So we'll construct a story together. So where am I? Goffney take, then we go to Paul take, right? Where am I? I'm in an amorous cosmos. I'm in a cosmos that is driven by Eros. I'm in a cosmos in which allurement animates reality. I'm in a cosmos which is a love story, and that love story has a plot line, and the plot line is, and again, this is not fanciful, this is not conjecture, this is the integration of the best interior and exterior sciences. The plot line of cosmos is the progressive deepening of intimacies. So evolution is the evolution of intimacy. In every crisis, is an evolutionary driver, and every crisis is a crisis of intimacy, and you can only solve a crisis of intimacy by generating a new level of intimacy. That's where we are. We're in an amorous cosmos. Paul, take it away. Where are we?
I think we're in the mirror, seeking desperately to realize what we are beyond our reflection.
So what you're pointing to, if I can... And this is, you invoked earlier in our conversation, Karst, who I haven't read, but Infinite and Finite Games. And in the Infinite Game, we play together. So let's play together. Okay, so we're going to play together. So
yeah.
What you're invoking is this realization that this story, which is a progressive deepening of intimacies, the plot line of evolution, is the evolution of intimacy. This is the yearning, the inconsolable longing to know reality and self ever more deeply.
Yes. See, what I'm saying is we're in the mirror trying to see who we are beyond our reflection because we've become externalized in our perception of self. So we've fallen in love with the mirror, the Narcissus myth. But I'm saying, but we've got to go, who am I beyond my, we got to come into our inner self, not only to find ourselves, but to find all of us together.
Gorgeous, 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 gorgeous. So I have to become intimate with self.
Yeah.
I have to become intimate with my true nature. I have to become intimate with the nature of the universe. I have to become intimate with my beloved, which is why Master Dogen said that enlightenment is intimacy with all things.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
Enlightenment means, right? So where are we? We are in an intimate universe. The plot line of this intimate universe is the progressive deepening of intimacies. And intimacy means nothing is split off, right? Nothing is dissociated. So actually, just like we have an Eros equation, holy brother, right? We have an intimacy equation, an interior science intimacy equation that you and I had an occasion once to talk about, but it's a beautiful place to invoke it. And we can feel it in terms of your offering. So intimacy is the notion, intimacy is the realization, intimacy equals shared identity, meaning nothing's split off, nothing's apart, shared identity in the context of otherness. So even though Mark and Paul were part of the same field of value, so we're part of the true self, which is the singular that has no plural, right? We're part of the same field of consciousness, and yet, we have shared identity, Mark and Paul, in the context of otherness. There's Paulness and there's Markness. But we're not separate selves competing. We're in the field of value together. We're expressions of the intimate universe. We're in the field of consciousness. We're part of the one mind and one heart, and yet we're irreducibly unique. and not, right? And we have to honor that irreducible uniqueness. So intimacy means we have shared identity in the context of otherness. Then we need more than that. We need mutuality of recognition. We have to recognize each other in our distinction. Mutuality of pathos. We have to feel each other. We need mutuality of value. There's a shared field of value that we operate in. Just like protons, neutrons, and electrons can form an atom because they're part of a shared field of value. And finally, we need mutuality of purpose. We have a shared vision. So that movement of intimacy is the vector, the plot line of the intimate universe. So if I'm in a couple, right, we need shared identity. There needs to be not just an I and an I, there needs to be a we, but the we doesn't reduce the I and the I, it's in the context of otherness. And then we need to actually recognize each other. And then we need to feel each other. And intimacy is you feel me and I feel you.
And then we dream together.
And then we have shared vision, mutuality of purpose and value. We dream together, right? We become dreamers together, right? We lucid dream together. We dream, right? And new awakening together. Wow, right? And that's the ultimate play. It's the ultimate joy. It's the ultimate creativity.
Yes.
Right?
And you know, interject please, slightly, I see what's going on in the world as almost a necessary reminding of what we're really doing here. You know, why we're, you understand? Like if your parents are rich and you never think about where your food comes from and you have a credit card with a bottomless pit, you can become bored while you're surrounded by exotic toys, food, and everything else, while all the poor kids are happy to play with a stick and a stone. But when you lose it and you're hungry and you've got nothing to play with and there's no money on your credit card, you all of a sudden awaken to what it was that you really had. Steiner talks about supersaturation. He says the danger with sweetening food with sugar and chemicals is that it upregulates the nervous system to such a high level that you can only satiate yourself by adding more until you poison yourself and you're dead.
Yes.
You see, we're at a point of supersaturation where we need to come back to first principles and awaken to the beauty of what we do have before we destroy it.
No, beautifully said, brother. And let me see if I can just reframe it with your permission. Other words, only when we stand to lose our humanity can we claim our humanity. Right? As long as our humanity was a given, we didn't actually need to define it. We didn't really need to know what it was. It just
bingo.
Was. But now as we're threatened with the death of our humanity, it's precisely when something's about to be taken away that I need to know what it is in order to keep it, right? And it's critical to understand that the Industrial Revolution exploited the boundaries of the natural world, the planetary boundaries, for the sake of rapacious greed. The Information Revolution, right, is not exploiting the boundaries of nature in the sense of the natural world, right? The Information Revolution in its current phase is exploiting and violating the boundaries of human nature. Right?
It's so also exploiting mental space.
Right, which is human nature, meaning it's human nature, meaning just like the Industrial Revolution went to conquer nature, the Information Revolution is going to conquer human nature. And if we want to have a human future, we need to actually claim our humanity. And to claim our humanity, we need to know, well, why does it matter to be a human being if I don't have the cognitive function available to artificial intelligence? And the answer is, because the quality of intimacy, the taste of Paul Checkmate, the personhood of Paul, the drama of decision-making of Paul, the story of Paul, not the victim story, not the obsessive, petty, contracted, right, you know, overly therapized story, but the dignity of Paul's story has irreducible value, and the irreducible, unique dignity of Paul's configuration of desire, right, has a gift to give to cosmos that was never available before. I mean, another way to say this in the lineage, right, is that actually every unique human being is more God to come.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
And if that's the part that people have forgotten, that's the part that they've, that's the field of value that they've departed from.
That's right. And to and conscious, beautiful brethren, and to awaken to conscious evolution is to be aware. And I shared this with my beloved friend, Barb Marks Hubbard, right before she passed, right? To awaken to conscious evolution is to be aware that I am more God to come. But it's a very precise awareness. It's not this kind of tinsel, you know, superficial kind of new age proclamation, I am God. You know, when people tell me in the new age, I am God, just tell them, could you just shut the fuck up and sit down? And I just relax, buddy, I am God. Or what does that mean? Just be a human being first. Then go in deep. Then realize deeply. Then get so humble that you get so audacious that you'll say, oh, I am God, right?
Yeah.
Right? But that I am God is not, it's not a casual declaration, right? It's not a new age claim. It's not, you know, what Trungpa called a spiritual materialism. It's this deep realization that my deepest heart's desire, my clarified heart's desire, when I've let go of my contraction, I've let go of the pettiness, I've let go of the attacks on others, I've let go of, you know, the kind of, you know, narcissistic, tragic violence that I impose, you know, under all sorts of pietistic guises and all sorts of tragic cover-ups. You know, people disguise themselves as teachers and people disguise themselves as victims, right? Mm. You know, and they're both abusive.
And those two go together.
Right? That's right. That's right. That's right. Right. In other words, there's many fig leaves for abusers, right? And, you know, in the victim triangle, we know that it looks like there's an abuser, you know, and a victim and a rescuer. That's what it looks like. But if you look more carefully, the person who seems to be the rescuer is often really the abuser. And the person who appears to be the victim is actually being violent and being aggressive. So it's a much more complex and nuanced reality. We let go of all that. And I actually access what is my deepest heart's desire, not my pseudo eros, not my pseudo desire, but my deepest heart's unique heart desire. And I realized, who am I? I am a unique configuration of desire, and my desire is the name of God. My desire is God's desire, and my desire is desire for more value, for more goodness, for more truth, for more beauty that can uniquely be incarnated only in me, as me, and through me. I actually realize the mad joy, mad responsibility, the insane laughter, and the wild tears. I am more God to come.
Yes. I think I am God needs to be replaced by I am Godding.
Yeah, beautiful. That's right. That's right.
And I think if you...
God is a verb.
Yes. If instead of I am God, i.e. omnipotent, the whole thing, I am Godding. I am expressing the beauty, the love, and the potential, the exploration of God, because that's what we're all doing. And the vision that came to me when you were talking about our departure from the field of value, because I'm very visual, is I saw a fish jumping so far out of the lake that it started to suffocate.
Yeah, beautiful. That is gorgeously said, my friend. That is gorgeously said, right? In other words, a fish, right, swims in the water of value.
And, yes.
And value is like space and time. You can't avoid value. Value is the very structure of reality. And in every move I make, I'm always evaluating, and my evaluation is always based on a field of value. So value is the air we breathe. Right? And just like there's an eye of the mind, which is cognitive, and there's the eye of the senses, which is empirical sensory, there's what I call, and we call it in cosmorotic humanism, and it's in this book, where there's an eye of value.
Hi, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the show. I imagine you know that magnesium is one of the minerals that people in North America are the most deficient in, but it's an extremely important mineral to have in your diet regularly. And believe it or not, Bioptimizers has improved what was already well known to be the best magnesium formula out there called Magnesium Breakthrough. So I've got Wade Lightheart with me to explain what it is they've done to improve this already excellent formula. Wade, what is new about your new Mag Breakthrough formula?
Well, it's called sucrosomial magnesium. So we have 7 different types of magnesium in Magnesium Breakthrough because they're uptaken by different parts of the body. But a new type of magnesium has been created called sucrosomial. And what it shows in the research and science is that it's actually even more absorbable by the body, particularly inside of the brain, which is a big aspect to enhance neurotransmitter formation, as well as ensuring the rest and relax response in the nervous system that a lot of people will take magnesium for. They find it, you know, clocks them down, helps them sleep better, allows for the relaxation of striated and smooth muscle tissue in the body, which creates an energetic relief. And so when we added sucrosomial, we were able to demonstrate inside our lab facility that we were able to get better improvements. Of course, we have a partnership with the Birch International University. We have some patents we're working on, which will kind of relay some of these things. But sucrosomial was a no-brainer when we added to the formula, improved the results or improved the uptake. And the reports back from our testing team were like, wow, this, we get more results with less caps. And that's always the goal for our company.
That's excellent. I love it. I always say, and people have probably heard me say it before, I just am so amazed how you guys are constantly and always improving and working your best to not only make better products for us, but it doesn't seem to me that it gets more expensive as you make them better. So that's a real gift to the world. Thank you.
Bioptimizers offers Living 4D with Paul Check listeners 10% off Magnesium Breakthrough and all their other products. Plus, there are always amazing gifts with purchase. So to grab yours, go to bioptimizers.com/living4D and use the promo code PAUL10 when you check out. That's bioptimizers.com/living4D and the discount code is PAUL10.
You know, for me, I'm going to share something from me personally.
Yeah.
Value is the soul of meaning. If you lose value, then meaning doesn't mean anything anymore. And when you lose meaning, you've lost the plot. And so you no longer know your dharma in the story.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous, my brother, right? So we're coming. That's gorgeous. So in other words, value, eros, meaning, right? Information at its core. Information at its core is not technical. It's not bits and bytes. Information is a structure of value in cosmos, right? So there's information. So information, meaning, value, they're all pointing to the same thing. That's the intrinsic eros value of cosmos. And I'm gonna create this new word, eros value.
Yeah.
Eros value of cosmos.
Information is what puts value in formation.
That's right. Information is the configuration of right relationship, or the configuration of intimacy, right? That is the right relationship between parts that creates new value and ever evolving value. So what is Paul? Paul is a unique configuration of intimacy, right?
And a unique configuration. So are we all.
A unique configuration of intimacy and desire. And when Paul becomes aware of that, he becomes aware of the mad joy in being more God to come. Right now, so let's see where we are for a second. So where are we? We're in an amorous cosmos, right? Who are we? We're unique expressions of the amorous cosmos in person.
Godding.
Right? I am a irreducibly unique expression of the amorous cosmos. Godding. I am eros in action. I am love in action, responding to need. That's who I am. I respond, I'm right. To be a human being is to be love in action in response to need. And ultimately, as my heart opens, I can feel not only the need of the person next to me, I can feel larger and wider fields of need. And ultimately, I can become homo amor. I become omni-considerate for the whole. I become omni-responsible for the whole, right? I can actually feel the whole, right? So that's who am I? And then finally, what ought be done? So if you actually feel into it, my brother, right, you know, we're using these words eros or outrageous love or evolutionary love, right? The amor of cosmos. And by all of them, we mean not ordinary love, which is a social construction, but eros, which is the heart of existence itself, or outrageous love, which is the heart of existence itself. So we can maybe say it in a couple of words. So who am I? I'm an outrageous lover. What should I be doing? Well, first off, I should keep every boundary that should be kept. And I should break every boundary that should be broken.
Yes.
Right. And so what should I be doing?
So penetrate and create novelty.
Right? And I want to create a new emergent. And how do I create a new emergent? I commit outrageous acts of love. An outrageous lover commits outrageous acts of love. Now, which outrageous acts of love ought, because there's an ought in cosmos. There's not just an is in cosmos. There's an ought. Which outrageous acts of love ought I be committing? Those that are an expression of my unique self.
Yes. Wow. I would also say, which acts of love ought I be committing? I ought to be committing the acts that restore value and meaning, because that's where the illusion has separated us from the water of life.
So in my circle of intimacy and influence, where I see breakdowns in value and meaning, I need to reweave the cosmos and effect a tikkun, a fixing, a repair, by actually both restoring and evolving value and meaning. So, and here's the thing. It's not my job to fix the whole thing. So a lot of times people get overwhelmed. And it's like, how can I relate to the whole? Right? It's too much. Right? And so we close our hearts because if we feel the pain of the whole, but we can't heal the pain of the whole, we're overwhelmed. So in the gap between our ability to feel the pain and our ability to heal the pain, we close our hearts. So how do I open my heart again? I've got to close that gap between my ability to feel and my ability to heal. How do I do that? I realize it's not my job to heal the whole thing. It's my job to heal the whole that lives in the particular part, which is in my unique circle of intimacy and influence. In other words, the outrageous acts of love that are mine to commit are not the same that are Paul's. Right? Paul has a different, right? And then we can come together, and there's some things that we do together. We do a unique self-symphony, and other things I do with this group of friends, and other things I do with that group of friends, but I do that which is mine to do, which is a function of my unique self, which is my unique instrument playing with others in the unique self-symphony.
I think you've touched on something important with, you know, it's overwhelming to look at the whole of it, the all of it.
Yeah, please.
Because it seems so massive, but it can also be, and it very often is, as you know, I'm a therapist and so are you, people can be overwhelmed with their own whole, the whole in their heart, so to speak, the wound. But the point I'm driving at is that it's okay to ask for help. You know, we doing your part can be inclusive of saying, Mark, I want to heal, but I need your help.
No, gorgeous.
People come to me all the time saying, Paul, I want to heal, but I don't know what to do. I've tried this. It's not working. And, you know, my job is to help them often to know where to look because they're looking in the wrong place. In other words, they're looking at the symptom, but they're not looking for the etiology, which is almost always their story, right?
So that is gorgeous and so true. Let me say a couple of things. First off, by the way, you're a therapist. I'm not. So I will leave therapy to you. I don't do
well. You talked about couples work. So I gave you the credit there.
I appreciate it. So I occasionally do work with couples, but not as a therapist. I don't have that skill. But if I do see people that need therapy, I will send them to you, right?
I'm busy. I'm too busy dealing with meta crisis.
But that's actually a great therapist is a wildly important skill. It's not a skill that I have, but I just want to kind of bow to the great therapist. That's just one. But two, so you say something so important here, which is uniqueness. When we say I commit the outrageous acts of love that are a function of my unique self, that my uniqueness doesn't isolate me. My uniqueness doesn't mean that I do them alone. And I want to make this distinction. It's a critical distinction between separateness and uniqueness. When I'm separate is the coin of alienation. Uniqueness is the currency of connection.
Yes, right? It's and what so makes I'm us unique, interesting to each other.
That's right. When I'm unique, I'm allured to you. So my uniqueness connects us, and then we join hands in the unique self-symphony, and we can commit our outrageous acts of love together, but with each one of us making an irreducibly unique contribution. And here's the thing. When I'm giving my unique gift, which is committing my unique outrageous acts of love, then all of a sudden the gap between my ability to feel the pain and my ability to heal the pain evaporates. Yeah. Because I'm actually playing my part in the unique symphony. And then I can open my heart again. And then I can be alive again. And then I can feel my eros again. And here's the thing. All mental breakdown comes from a failure of eros, right? Because my eros, my sense of feeling the currency of fullness, of being aligned with the value of cosmos breaks down, and I become a desiccated separate self, the hollow men and the stuffed men. So then the yearning for my wholeness is so overwhelming, but I'm told there is no wholeness, so I break down. So you can't, and I say this not as a therapist, I say this as a, you know, kind of whatever, world philosopher, a spiritual friend, right? A cultural critic, right? Whatever you want to call it, a pandit, but and it's just absolutely true. You cannot heal a person, right? You cannot restore wholeness without restoring the person's life. I can't heal myself without restoring my own life. You can't just move around chairs on the deck of the Titanic by doing a bunch of psychological exercises or healing past traumas and expect the person to become whole. I can only become whole if I can recover my unique self. It's only unique self-recovery that begins to make me whole. It's only through recovering my unique self that I can play my instrument in the unique self symphony, which is my true nature. As long as I'm involved in separate self striving, all of the psychological work will break down, which is why, by the way, which is why Jung was not incorrect when he said, I can, and he was a therapist, as of course we know. He
says, one of the best.
Right. One of the best, as you know much more about this than I do. So I completely trust you on that. But he says very beautifully, he says, unless this is just one example, he says, unless my patient has some access to the larger sense of immortality, I can't actually work effectively with the patient. Right. Meaning if I'm in a separate self, narrow materialist reductionist story, right, in which I'm a bot on the web, a downgraded human, and I live a short amount of time with my basic universal income that somehow they passed for me, right? I'm going to be devastated and desiccated and depressed, right? And bipolar acting out and dysregulated, right? Because I'm not actually who I am unless I actually experience myself in the field of Eros. Let's go back to where we started. We said, what's this? Where is this? What is this basic book about? First principles and first values. It's about one thing. Reality is not merely a fact. Reality is a story. Reality is not an ordinary story. Reality is a love story. Reality is not an ordinary love story. Reality is an outrageous love story. And outrageous love is not mere human sentiment. It's not a social contrivance. It's the heart of existence itself. And your love story, my love story, is chapter and verse in the universal love story. Wow. That's a new story of value, my friend.
And that's, you know, in my own words, for my own reasons.
Please, brother.
That's more wholesome than religion because it is really an emergent form of medicine for the old religion. The old religion got us here. Now we need to penetrate and create novelty in your words. We've got to get past books and get into relationships with each other.
But that's gorgeous, my friend. And it's funny, you know, 10 years ago, I would have, you know, just nodded at the beauty of your words. And I still nod at the beauty of your words. But I've shifted somewhat in terms of how I use the word religion. In other words, when we first started the think tank, I started with Ken Wilber and with Sally Kempton. And, you know, very, very early on, Diane Hamilton was involved, but, you know, then went into her own beautiful work. And, you know, then Zach Stein joined later, and Lori Galper and Marina Kaplan. And when we started, we called it the Center for World Spirituality, right? You know, then at a certain point, you know, a few years later, it's a very interesting story. We said, okay, we really need the word wisdom there. Wisdom that integrates everything. So we called it, we became a Center for Integral Wisdom, you know? But then at a certain point, we realized, no. We actually need to reclaim this new vision of religion, not the old religion about which Voltaire said, remember the cruelties, not the pre-modern dogmatic religion, but we actually need a world religion as a context for our diversity.
Yeah, the religion I'm talking about is the one that made Nietzsche say God is dead.
No, I totally know. What I'm tenderly suggesting, my brother, is that we need to start reclaiming the world religion.
The word or the world?
the word. We need to reclaim the word.
We have to understand what it really means. That's part of the problem.
We completely agree. So we actually renamed the center. And we renamed the center. It's a whole new website, right? It's now 14 years old, the center, but we renamed it the Center for World Philosophy and Religion.
I've seen it. I've been there.
Right. No, I know. And the reason is because we actually have to evolve religion.
Yes, we do.
So I've come to realize that we actually need, when I was younger, I said, well, let's talk about spirituality and, you know, and the Tao, and that's all beautiful and it's all true, you know, and we need to reclaim and invest new meaning in words like God, in words like religion. And maybe on my side, I can close. One of the most exciting things that happened to me this year, my brother, I mean, it was just intensely beautiful in the world of kind of just being with Shi and the Dharma and trying to tell this new story of value, is a name of God appeared that we were able to actually resonate and feel and share. And the name of God which appeared is God is the infinite intimate.
Yes, I've heard you mention that before.
Right, the infinite intimate, right?
Yeah, I've even quoted you on that.
Beautiful, right? God's the infinite intimate.
It's profoundly true.
Profoundly true, right? Right. And just to say, if I can, it's my last word is just a intense joy to be with you, my friend.
You too, bud. I always love it. You know, we've got so much to do together. And I don't just mean you and I mean all of us who can see the hole in the ship. The Titanic is sinking, and it's, you know, moving the furniture on the deck is not the issue right now. It's like really, and interestingly, the Titanic in my metaphor is made of each of us. And we've all got to plug the hole in our heart.
Oh my God.
And that will keep the boat afloat. And that boat is the lifeboat, the love boat, right? The real one.
Amen. Amen.
And all we got to do is plug our piece and open our creativity up and get into the infinite game and out of the finite game.
And play, but play, you know, play is the most serious thing. And perhaps if I can, you know, actually say playfully and seriously, and it's something I've never done on a podcast before, but if I can, with your permission, just to make a request of people, right? It's not something that I'm good at particularly, but it's such a critical point that, you know, sharing this book in the world. So I would like to ask everyone, if you can, you know, in the show notes or in the, you know, you can actually go directly to Amazon. If you could just personal favor to Shi, to me, to Wei, to Paul, is to actually go get a copy of the book, read it, send us an email, right? You know, how you read it, how you tasted it, how you experienced it. Let's talk about it together. We're writing the next set now in the Great Library, but to really just to invite everyone to kind of get First Principles and First Values, which is the name of the book. You can get it on Amazon. It's written by David J. Temple, who's our pseudo anonymous author. And just to really, if we could put this book into the world, which is this first telling of the new story, and we can put in, and we, just to make clear, we make no profit on it. It all goes into kind of writing the next, it all goes into writing the next books. But if we could get in the next few weeks, you know, 10,000 of these, the first 10,000 into the world, and that would be a wondrous first step. So I just invite everyone to buy one, buy 10, send it to your friends. And again, this is actually the first time in my life, right, on a podcast or a public forum where I've asked someone to do something. But I know that we're at a moment, we just need this book, First Principles and First Values, to be in the world. And just to also notice, everyone, you know, the book's not written under my name. It's not written under Zach's name. It's not written under our co-author Ken's name. It's written as David J. Temple. And David J. Temple is all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the new human and the new humanity, you know, writing together.
I love it. I'm excited to read it myself. Are you going to do it on audio at all?
Yes. There's an audio book that's actually out now. It's already available. You can get an audio.
Oh, I'll get on it.
It's on audio and it's on Kindle.
Oh, good. Well, I'll get them both.
Yeah. Paul, I love you. I love you too, man.
Buddy. Yes. Yeah, you're a joy in my life, man. You always stimulate all the neural circuits in my heart and my mind, and they start dancing together. And I feel hope when I get to spend time with you and people like you that are
Thank you.
Aware and alive and passionate. You know, I must say, I really enjoy living with you. And if I had to die, I would enjoy dying with you, because I have a feeling you and I would come up with some good jokes as we were dying.
We would. That is really, I mean, tears in my eyes. It's the most beautiful thing to say. You know, it reminds me of that beautiful scene in Tolkien at the end of Lord of the Rings, and, you know, where Frodo and Sam, you know, Frodo says to Sam, or Sam says to Frodo, he says, they think that they're going to die, and they're on this little slab of rock and surrounded by fire. And he says, it's good to be with you here at the end of times, right? Yeah. You know, in other words, and if it was the end of times, I'd want to be gathered around a table with you, my friend.
Yeah, you too. And all of the people that we share with, right?
All of our friends, you
have a beautiful collection, Ken Wilber, all the people you mentioned. And I've interviewed the people that turned me on, you know, and I have friends, Kyle Kingsbury, Jason Picard, you know, a lot of, you know, the people that I have the joy of working together, and all of them are doing their best for the world, you know? And I think one of the beauties of the podcast is, my dream is that we get to be a lot more people's friends, and they get to be our friends, because we're all in that same field of value, and we all come together to say, you know, Mark wakes me up in a special way, Paul wakes me up in a special way, and we send emails and requests and letters and comments, and they wake us, and we go, oh, we can see there's something that needs to be addressed. So it's like a, you know, it's the boomerang of love. It's always feeding itself. And I think that's the joy of what I do and what you do, is we really are giving the best of ourselves for the rest of ourselves, and inspiring everybody to do the same. And I think that's all it's going to take to really heal. You know, that's all we got to do, is give the best of ourselves for the rest of ourselves.
Amen, brother.
Madly. Thank you, buddy.
Madly, brother. Madly. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for getting a hold of Mark's book, First Values and First Principles, or First Principles and First Values. And thank you to my sponsors for all your amazing products, and really doing your best to give us the nutrition we need to keep our brains turned on and our blood pumping strong, and practicing sustainable practices and helping the world be better and the soil be healthier. And thank you to all of you. You're in our heart. You're in our soul. And we're doing this together. I have no fear. I have a lot of hope, because the worst thing that could happen to me is I would die, and I can get the rest of my questions answered, but I want to hang out for the kids before I go get the ones I can't get answered here, there. So I say to Mark, this is for the children of the world. If anyone's taken the short end of the stick on this whole thing, it's the kids. And so let's all do it for the kids. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for the kids, man. They don't deserve the chaos and the confusion. They deserve a better, more full, more rich environment to live and love and play in, and they are our future. So let's do it for
beautifully
the kids.
For tomorrow's generations, for the memory of the future.
Exactly.
Amen.
Lots of love, buddy.
Lots of love, buddy. I love you, man.
Let's not stay away from each other. Let's get together and do it again.
Again, soon.
I know you got a volume 2 coming. We got to talk about it.
Volume 2 coming down.
All right, bud.
I love you.
Thank you. Love you too.
Thank you for listening to Living 4D with Paul Check and today's guest, Dr. Mark Gaffney. You can find Mark online at markgaffney.com. That's MarcGaffney.com. Or connect with him on Instagram, Twitter, and Substack at Mark Gaffney. And on Facebook, LinkedIn, and TikTok at Dr. Mark Gaffney. Watch more on his YouTube channel at youtube.com/MarkGaffney. The book First Principles and First Values is now available at bit.ly/First Principles Book. That's bit.ly/First Principles Book. And Paul encourages you to go get your own copy. Mark offers a free weekly broadcast Plus, listeners can download chapters 1 to 4 of the award-winning Your Unique Self book by going to onemountainmanypaths.org/your-unique-self. That's onemountainmanypaths.org/your-unique-self. His books, Your Unique Self, The Radical Path to Personal Enlightenment, and A Return to Eros, The Radical Experience of Being Fully Alive, are available on Amazon and at all good bookstores. And you can read more articles from Mark on his website. His mini course, Your Unique Self, can be taken free at uniqueselfinstitute.com/the-unique-self-mini-course. For more links to Mark's work, please check the show notes at checkinstitute.com/podcast. You can catch up with Paul on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at paul.check, on X at paulcheck, or on his YouTube podcast channel, youtube.com/living4D with Paul Check. Watch more on Paul's blog at paulchecksblog.com, or visit the Check Institute site at checkinstitute.com to find Paul's e-learning courses, advanced training programs, and to learn more about the Check Academy. A big thank you again to our premier sponsors, Bioptimizers, Paleo Valley, and Organifi. We could not produce this podcast without their support, and all the sponsors offer special discounts for our listeners. So please visit the show notes page at checkinstitute.com/podcast for the links and details. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and a warm review on the podcast platform of your choice. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, and YouTube.